so to grips. But before I went to the next step, I couldn't help looking over toward the balloon. My pursuit of this payload had taken me well away from it, but I was heartened to see a number of blues and reds converging there. Surve and Fra Osa had linked half a dozen payloads into a big, lazily spinning molecule of fuzzballs and were hauling it in, getting ready to link it to a growing complex in the shelter of the balloon. Archibald reported,
"I'm closing on Fra Jad. He has become entangled with a blue payload and he seems to be unconscious."
"What kind of orbital elements are you seeing?" Leo asked.
"His E is dangerously high," Archibald said,
referring to the eccentricity of Jad's orbit.
"He'll be in the soup in a few minutes."
"Be careful you don't get entangled then,"
Leo warned him. "Rear grapnel camera on," I said, and the view out my face mask was obscured by a virtual display in jewel-like laser colors. A green grid with a red crosshairs in the middle. This was a feed from a spelecaptor aimed out the back of my Magnifique. I checked my pitch angle and then rotated the trackball until it had incremented by 180 degrees. The payload swung into view. It was now directly behind me.
"Grapnel 1, fire," I said,
and felt a little kick in the tail as a small cylinder of compressed gas ruptured. The grapnel system was a long, skinny tube of fabric, all telescoped in on itself like a stocking. When the gas exploded into it, the tube shot out straight and became a long, rigid balloon. At its end was a warhead, rounded smooth on its tip so that it would plunge through the cloud of netting surrounding a payload, but spring-loaded with spines that sprang out when the tube reached the end of its travel, or when it smacked into something. Based on my imperfect view through the rear camera, I was pretty certain it had all worked. But there was only one way to be sure. "Rear grapnel camera off," I said, and thrust forward. For a couple of seconds, I don't think my heart beat at all. Then a jerk backwards told me my grapnel had engaged the netting. I allowed myself a shout of joy, then checked the balloon again. Archibald reported,
"Jad is welded to the payload. I'll never get them apart."
Leo,
"What do you mean, welded?"
Archibald,
"When he drifted into it, the blue plastic netting contacted the hot nozzle skirt on his Magnifique and melted, stuck fast. I'm attempting to grapple the two payloads as a unit."
Leo,
"Do you have sufficient propellant to make the necessary burn?"
Archibald,
"I'll tell you in a minute."
Leo,
"I'm on my way. Don't expend all your propellant. We don't even know if Jad is still alive."
17 minutes to line of sight. Plenty of time. I got myself oriented as before with the payload trailing behind me and thrust forward, undoing the damage I'd inflicted on my orbit a few moments earlier. It took more fuel, a longer burn, because I was moving double the mass now. Some nervousness here, because a long burn meant a large mistake if I was doing it wrong. I kept an eye on the eccentricity readout at the bottom of my display. This was already about 0.005, but I had to make it less than 0.001 to stay in any kind of reasonable sync with everyone else. In my earphones, I could hear others making a similar calculation. Archibald, I gathered, had succeeded in grappling Jad in the payload Jad was stuck to, and was trying to do what I was doing, calling out numbers to Leo, who was maneuvering into position to rescue Archibald if that became necessary. Meanwhile, Jesri was monitoring the traffic, calculating how much propellant was going to be needed, calling out suggestions that, as the adventure went on, hardened into commands. The distraction was severe, so I reluctantly shut off my wireless link and focused on my own situation. Only once I'd burned my E down under 0.001 did I lift my hands from the controls and look around for the balloon. After a few moments' wild anxiety, when I didn't think it was anywhere near me, I found it above and to my right, 1,000 feet away, and slowly getting closer. A cluster of blue netting was forming up below it as other Cell 317ers brought in payloads. As long as I was so close, I took a look around to see if there were any others handy. 15 minutes to line of sight. I'd lost contact with Archibald and Leo, but several other icons came up on my display as I drifted in range of the reticule. I turned the sound back on, not without intense trepidation, since I did not know what news I was about to hear. Screaming filled my ears, overloaded the electronics. I tried to remember how to turn down the volume. The tone was not that of a horror show, more like a sporting event where someone wins a close game with an improbable score just as time expires. Leo's icon popped up.
"Calm down, calm down,"
he insisted, appalled by the lapse of discipline. Arcibalt's icon came up.
"Saman, prepare to grab Frajad, please. He's unresponsive."
His voice was weighed down with a kind of unnatural calm, but I sensed that if I checked his bio readouts, they would reflect near-fatal excitement. The balloon was rapidly getting bigger. I was too high, though, too far from Arb, so I juked northwest, killing a bit of my orbital velocity, dropping to a lower altitude. I say juked northwest as if it were that simple, but now that I was towing a payload on the end of a 20-foot grapnel, such moves were much more complicated. First, I had to swing around to get on the payload's other side, then apply thrust. This slowed my convergence on the balloon. Saman said,
"Got him. He's alive. Bio readouts are screwy, though."
Everyone had been paying attention to Frajad being towed in by Arcibalt, but suddenly all I heard was shouting,
"Look out, look out! Damn it!
That was close!" and,
"Bad news, it's a red."
Twisting my head around, I saw what they had been reacting to. A red payload had passed within a few yards of the balloon, moving at a high relative speed, fast enough to have done damage if it had been just a little bit higher. It had come upon them so rapidly that no one had reacted in time to head it off, grapple it, and rein it in. It passed between me and the balloon, and I got a good look at it.
"It's the nuke," I announced.
Then I said to my suit,
"Grapnel, disengage."
"Disengaged," it returned. I fired a little burst to pull myself free of the blue payload.
"I'm on it,"
I announced.
"Someone grab this payload."
The nuke was moving so fast that I reverted to instincts cultivated playing the video game in Elkhazg. I fired a lateral burst that, while it didn't solve the problem, slowed the rate at which the gap between me and the nuke was widening. Icons were falling off my display as I shot out of range, and the sound was coming through as sporadic, disjointed packets. I was pretty sure I heard Arcibalt saying, "Wrong plane," which tallied with what I was thinking. This nuke's orbit was in a plane that differed from ours by a small angle, just because of some small error that had crept in during the chaos of launch. One voice, anyway, came through clearly. 13 minutes to line of sight. I tried another maneuver, screwed it up desperately, and, with feelings that were close to panic, watched the nuke zoom across my field of vision. A moment later, Arb whipped beneath me, and I realized I was spinning around. My hand must have brushed the trackball and set it spinning. I devoted a few moments to getting my attitude stabilized, then spun about carefully so that I wouldn't lose my fix on the nuke. Once I had that in hand, I glanced back toward the balloon. It was shockingly distant. When I looked back toward the nuke, I couldn't see it. I'd lost it in sun glare off the equatorial sea. Back thrusting to lose altitude, I was able to find the red fuzzball again as it rose above the horizon. No one else was anywhere near. They had heard me saying I had the nuke and assumed I could handle it. "Calm down," I said to myself. Doing this slowly and getting it right on the next try would get me back to my friends quicker than making 3 hasty failed attempts. I got myself stabilized so that the nuke was low in my field of vision and dead ahead, and forced myself to spend 30 seconds doing nothing except tracking it, observing how its motion differed from mine. Definitely an error in the slant of its orbital plane. I had to fire the thrusters to match that error, which I did, but in the process I messed up my semi-major axis and a couple of other elements in a way that would have killed me 10 minutes later. Another 60 seconds fussing got those squared away. Plane change maneuvers are expensive. I'd been forcing myself not to look for the balloon anymore, partly because I was afraid of what I'd see, my shelter, my friends, impossibly far away, but also because it simply didn't matter. Without the nuke, whose power would split water into hydrogen and oxygen, we would all asphyxiate within a couple of hours. If I lost my nerve and retreated to the balloon without it, my empty-handed arrival would be a death sentence for the whole cell. I came near but got slewed sideways at the last minute, did a little spin move, stopped myself, where stopped meant that the nuke and I were stationary with respect to each other. 3 minutes to line of sight, said the voice. I gave the controls the tiniest nudge, saw to my satisfaction that the nuke and I were converging. Just let it happen. Tried not to breathe so fast. Rather than grappling the nuke, I spent a few moments maneuvering close enough that I could simply reach out with my skill-a-hand and grab the netting. Then I turned, making my best guess as to where the balloon might be, and saw nothing. Or rather, too much. Our decoy strategy had backfired. At this distance, I had no way to distinguish true from false. There were 3 balloons about the same distance from me, none closer than 10 miles. Even if I were to guess right, I wouldn't be able to reach it in 3 minutes, and if I guessed wrong, I'd use up so much thruster propellant in getting to it that I'd be marooned there. On the other hand, the orbit that I and the nuke were in was a stable one. I double-checked the numbers, since all our lives depended on my judgment of this. The orbit's shape and size were such that it would not enter the atmosphere and burn up, at least not for a day or two. What if I simply stayed with it? My oxygen supply was down to about 2 hours, but I could stretch it by calming down a little. I knew for a fact that the problem here was in the inclination of the orbit, the angle that the nuke and I were now making with respect to the equator. Ours was a little steeper than my comrades. Consequently, my trajectory would only coincide with cell 317's in 2 places, 2 points of intersection, occurring once every 45 minutes on opposite sides of the planet. Sort of like the proverbial stopped clock that's right twice daily. The last time it had been right had been about 15 minutes ago, when the nuke had almost hit my friends and I'd gone after it. Since then, we'd been getting farther apart. But starting in another few minutes, we'd begin getting closer together again. And in half an hour, we should enjoy another near collision. 1 minute to line of sight. The key to it all. What were my friends thinking? What were they saying right now over that wireless ret? I'd heard Archibald's voice saying that the nuke was in the wrong plane. They'd probably watched me drifting away with mounting anxiety and debated whether to send out a rescue team. But they hadn't. Leo had given no such order. Not only that, they had fought off the temptation to switch on the long-range wireless. If it had been anyone else, I wouldn't have been able to read their minds, nor they mine. But my fraas had been raised, trained, by Orlo. They had figured out, probably sooner than I had, that in 45 minutes the nuke would reappear on the other side of Arb. Just as important, they were relying on me, entrusting me with their lives, to figure out the same thing and to act accordingly. And what did act accordingly mean? It meant stay calm, and don't mess with the orbit that I was in. If I took no action, they'd be able to anticipate my position. If I did something, though, they'd have no way of predicting my whereabouts. I didn't have much in the way of emergency supplies, just a blanket of metallized poly, like the emergency blanket they had issued to Orlo after his anathem, taped to the chest of my suit. It was to be used to block the light of the sun where necessary, from striking our matte black suits with full force and overheating them, which would force the chiller to work harder and use more oxygen. I peeled mine loose and unfolded it, not easy with skella hands, and used it to cover as much of the nuke as I could, then snuggled beneath it. Line of sight established. Supposing they were looking, the telescopes on the Dabanernud could now see me, albeit as just another hunk of crud thrown up in the 200-missile launch. Chaff. Let's put this in perspective. The Dabanernud was something like 14,000 miles away. At their closest approach to Arb, the whole planet looked as big to them as a pie held at arm's length. At their farthest, the size of a saucer. For them to see my spread-out blanket at this distance was like trying to spot a gum wrapper from 100 miles away. Worse, or for me, better, it was like looking at a whole field covered with litter, trying to pick out a single gum wrapper from all the rest. On the other hand, Leo, who had brought Praxic-age exoatmospheric weapon systems with him to the Convox, had cautioned us not to get cocky, and Jules had added weight to this by telling us how the Ernudans, past masters of space warfare, had coupled SynDevs to excellent telescopes, enabling them to sift through vast numbers of images to find things that didn't look right. Decoys, for example, were easy to detect because they were usually nothing more than balloons whose huge size and light weight made them feel the drag of the evanescent atmosphere much more than real payloads. So decoy orbits behaved a little differently from non-decoy ones. Moreover, once the Ernudans had created a census of all the stuff that the 200-missile launch had flung into orbit, they would be in a position to notice if anything went missing or changed to a new orbit. This could only happen if it had thrusters and guidance on board. So, in that sense, we had already screwed up the mission. We had to fall back on safety in numbers, the hope that my blanket's sudden disappearance from the junk cloud would not be noticed soon enough for the pedestal to do anything about it. But I was getting ahead of myself. In order for this blanket to suddenly disappear, I was going to have to rendezvous with the others. That would be easier with oxygen. I closed my eyes, tried to relax, tried to stop thinking about the pedestal and their admirable telescopes and their SynDevs. Here was that rare circumstance where worrying too much actually could kill me. Once my pulse had dropped to a more reasonable range, I found the keyboards in my arm stumps and typed messages to Cord and to Ayla, in case I died and the suit was recovered later with its memory intact. The suit's SynDev included an orbital theorics calculator, which one almost never had time to use in the heat of the moment, but I fired it up and used it to verify some of my hunches as to what I'd need to do when I drew within range of the others. It was infuriatingly difficult to concentrate, though. My brain had become like an old sponge that has sopped up more water than it can hold. In zero gravity, there was almost no contact between the suit and the person wearing it. Air, at just the right temperature, circulated all around my naked body. It was like taking a bath in air. Behind my back was a small chemical plant going full tilt, but I was only aware of it as a source of gentle white noise. Other than that, I heard nothing except the beating of my own heart. Normally, I could get a jolt of excitement simply by opening my eyes and looking out the face mask. I'm in space. But now all I could see was the backside of a crinkly blanket, as if I were poultry in a roasting pan. So it was not difficult to feel drowsy. My body and my mind had never had so many reasons to want rest. Between jet lag and training, we had slept very little at Elkhazg, and not at all in the last 24 hours. The last half hour had been absurdly stressful. Just the kind of experience after which any sane person would want to crawl under the covers of a warm bed and cry himself to sleep. The only thing that kept me from passing out instantly was fear of my own sleepiness. After the training we'd been through, I now knew the symptoms of carbon dioxide poisoning better than the alphabet. Nausea. Check. Dizziness. Check. Vomiting. Check. Headache. Check. But who wouldn't have all of those symptoms after being kicked up a 100-mile-high staircase by a magnifique? What came next? Oh yeah, almost forgot. Drowsiness and confusion. I checked the readouts in my screen. Checked them again. Closed my eyes, waited for my vision to clear, checked them a third time. They were fine. Oxygen tank level was yellow, which was to be expected, after all the heavy breathing. The oxygen content of the air I was breathing was fine, and the CO2 level was zero. The scrubber was taking all of it out. But if I were drowsy and confused, might I be reading the numbers wrong? I drifted off, but started awake every few minutes. Enough time had passed that I began to second-guess what had happened just after the launch. I'd been so focused on what I'd been doing that when I had noticed Jad bumping into the blue payload and getting stuck to it, I decided not to go check it out. That had been a mistake. I should have gone for it. Instead, Arcibald had gone after Jad, and to judge from the way Jessery had been screaming when Arcibald had made it back, he had just barely escaped with his life and Jad's. This was a bad plan. Who had come up with the idea of doing it this way? I understood the logic. Arb had 200 missiles, no more. each just barely capable of getting a tiny payload to a dangerously low and short-lived orbit. There was only so much we could do working from that. We'd all studied the planet Elkhazg, come to grips with it, nodded our heads, accepted it. But that was one thing. To be up here with payloads zooming around chaotically, bumping into each other, getting melted together, hiding under space blankets, there were so many ways this could have gone wrong. Could still go wrong. Could be going wrong now. What if I'd been a little hastier when I had reached the nuke and made a bid to drag it back? We'd all have died. I was worrying again. Actually, it was worse than that, even more pointless. Rather than worrying about the future, which could be changed, I was worrying about things that might have gone wrong in the past and couldn't be changed in any case. Leave that to the Enchantress and the Redders, respectively. Where were all of the Thousanders now? Gathered in a stadium, chanting,
"Raz!"
I opened my eyes. Had one of those moments when I simply couldn't figure out where I was, could not convince myself that the launch hadn't been a dream.
"Raz!"
One icon was visible on the display. Fra Jesri.
"Here,"
I said.
"It's great to hear your voice,"
he exclaimed, sounding enormously relieved. "Well, I'm touched to hear you say so, Jesri."
"Shut up. I'm incoming. Get the blanket out of the way so you can get a clue what's going on."
"Are you sure? Aren't we in line of sight?"
"No."
"I think that we are in line of sight, Jesri."
"We were last time. Now we're not."
"Last time?"
"We missed you first time around. Crossed your path, but the altitude difference was too great. Couldn't raise you on the wireless."
"This is our second try?" I checked the time. He was right. 90 minutes, not 45, had passed. My oxygen indicator had gone red. I'd slept through the first rendezvous. I swiped the blanket out of the way, saw a balloon a mile away and rapidly getting closer. Tucked up under it was an ungainly structure of inflated grapnel tubes with dozens of red and blue fuzzballs caught up in it. A few space-suited figures on Monufiques kept stationed nearby, all turned to look my direction. The row of icons flashed up as I rejoined the reticule. But no one spoke except Jesri. He had come out alone.
"If I fail, remain calm and wait," he said. "There are two layers of backup plans."
"But they sent the best first, eh?" I kicked away from the nuke, very gently, and fired a grapnel into its net cloud.
"Thanks, but for doing what you did, you get bragging rights, Raz."
Jesri had floated in range. He spun about, collected himself, and fired a grapnel of his own.
"Maybe we can brag when we're old," I said. "What should I do?"
"Orient positive radial,"
he said. This meant that instead of facing in the direction of our orbital movement as before, we had to swing around 90 degrees so that our backs were to Arb. I did it, and bumped lightly against Jesri as we came around side by side.
"Rotate down 45 degrees and fire a 15-second burst," Jesri said.
15 seconds was huge, and if the calculations had been wrong, would send us far off course with no propellant to get back. But I did it. Didn't even think of not taking the suggestion. This was Jesri. He had been watching me coolly as I'd gone out to fetch the nuke, had done the theorix in his head and triple-checked it with the SynDev. I swiveled and fired, lost my visual in so doing.
"You are headed for us as if we were reeling you in on a line,"
Saman proclaimed. But his tone of voice was all I really needed to hear.
"Take no action," Leo warned us. "You're passing under us. We are coming to grapple you."
And a moment later, two sudden yanks and a cheer from the others told me we'd been captured. I took my fingers off the thruster controls just to prevent my trembling hands inadvertently firing the thrusters and let Leo and Osa tow us in.
"Raz, you're secure,"
Leo said.
"Saman, final star check, please."
"We are still shielded by the balloon," Saman said.
"Good,"
Leo said.
"I'm sure everyone wishes to congratulate Fra Erasmus, but don't. Save oxygen. Do it later. Archibald, you know what's next. Let us know if you need to borrow oxygen from someone else."
The others had pulled on white overgarments of tough fabric to stop micrometeoroids and to reflect the heat of the sun. These made them look more like proper spacemen.
One was given to me, and I put it on. Then, like the others, I snap-linked myself to this huge tangle of nets and payloads and grapnels and tried to sleep, while Archibald and Leo got the tender online. This meant maneuvering it and the nuke closer together, and then connecting them. Already connected to the tender was a flexible water bladder. Other cell members had been busy during my absence, scavenging water from the reservoirs on the blue payloads and transferring it into this bag, which had plumped out until it was bathtub-sized. Archibald snap-linked himself to the control panel of the nuke and spent a lot of time motionless, which probably meant he was reading the instructions on the virtual screen inside his face mask and going through checklists. After a while, he got to work deploying some long poles that ended up sticking out from one side of the nuke like spines. Petals blossomed from near their ends, blocking our view of whatever was on the tips of those poles. Archibald returned to the control panel and worked for a few moments, then informed us,
"I have powered up the reactor. Avoid the ends of the poles. They are hot."
"Hot, as in radioactive?" Jessery asked.
"No, hot as in ouch. They are where the system radiates its waste heat into space."
Then, after a pause,
"But they're also radioactive."
No one said anything. But I'm sure I wasn't the only one who checked his oxygen supply. The water was now being split into hydrogen and oxygen. In a few hours, we'd be able to replace our depleted air and fuel supplies and swap used for fresh scrubbers at the tender. Until then, we had to take it easy and share what we had with others who needed it more. Esma, for example, had been responsible for scavenging water from payloads and had used up a lot of her oxygen. Leo said,
"Everyone except Saman and Gratho drink, eat, and sleep. If you absolutely can't sleep, review coming tasks. Saman and Gratho, connect us."
Saman and Gratho clambered free of their monofiques and took to shinnying around the payload tangle. They found some kind of magic box, broke it free from the mess, and got it lashed into a position where it enjoyed a clear line of sight down to Arb. A few minutes later, Saman announced that we were on the reticulum. But I already suspected that based on new lights and Jija displays that had begun to flourish in my peripheral vision.
"Hello, Frau Rasmus. This is Cell 87, said a voice in my ears. "Can you hear me?"
"Yes, Tullia, I can hear you fine. Good morning, or whatever it is where you are."
"Evening," she said. "We're in the equipment shed of a farm about 1,000 miles southwest of Tredegar. What took you guys so long?"
"We were enjoying the view and having a party," I said. "How have you been spending the time? What is it that Cell 87 does in that equipment shed?"
"Whatever makes things easier for you."
"Tullia, I've hardly ever known you to be so helpful, so compliant. Looks like you need to urinate. What's the holdup?"
"I'll get right on it." "Any particular reason your pulse is so rapid?"
"Gosh, I don't know. Let me think."
"Spare me," she said. "Here's a picture of the mess you're in. Check it out while you're peeing."
And just like that, my screen was filled with a three-dimensional rendering of a big silver sphere with a mess of struts, fuzzballs, and color-coded payloads tucked up against one side of it.
"Here's where you are."
My name flashed in yellow.
"Here's where you need to be."
A payload began flashing on the other side of the mess.
We worked out the most efficient route.
A line snaked through, linking my name to the destination.
"That doesn't look so efficient," I began.
She cut me off.
"There's stuff you don't know. Each of the others in your cell has to follow a different route to a different payload. This one is optimized to minimize interference."
"I stand corrected."
A flashing red box appeared about halfway along my route.
"What's the red thing?" I asked.
She conferred with someone in the equipment shed, then answered, "One of the payloads has a sharp corner you'll want to avoid. No worries, we'll talk you through it."
"Gosh, thanks."
Rustling papers, she announced, "I'm going to talk you through the process of unstrapping yourself from the S-235B.
Up here we call it a monofique."
"Whatever.
Move your right hand up to the buckle above your left collarbone."
I'll describe what we did next as if we had just done it. In the act, though, it was, as the old joke goes, a whole hour's work packed into just one 24-hour day. It would have been 24 days, though, if not for our support cells on the ground, keeping track of what we were doing and coming up with ways to make it easier. During rest breaks, ruthlessly enforced by our private physicians, I learned that Arcibald's cell was in a drained swimming pool in a triangle arc parochial suvin, and Leo's was on an unmarked Drummond parked at a maintenance depot. And as slowly became plain, each of these cells was in turn being supported by networks of other cells out there in the anti-swarm. Work began with disentangling and sorting the goods we had hauled in during that first feverish 20 minutes. Survey tended to Jules Verne Durand and to Fra Jad. Both ended up being fine. The Lateran was weak from lack of nutrition and had suffered more from the ride up to orbit. It simply took him longer to become himself again. It wasn't really clear what had happened to Fra Jad. He was unresponsive for a while, though his vital signs were in acceptable ranges and his eyes were open. Eventually, he requested that Survey leave off pestering him. Then he dropped off the reticule and did nothing for an hour. Finally, he began to move and to take part in the unpacking. I wondered who was in his support cell. The fuzzballs we stripped off, wadded up, and got out of the way. The payloads we strapped together with poly ties, just so they wouldn't drift out from the shelter of the balloon and give away our position. We rigged the payload cluster to a Magnifique and used its thrusters for station keeping. The balloon's low mass and high drag made it inevitable that we'd drift out from under its shelter unless we tapped the thrusters every so often to slow ourselves down. If we did this for more than a couple of days, we'd re-enter the atmosphere along with the balloon, and there would be a sort of race to see whether incineration or crushing deceleration would kill us first. But we had no intention of hanging around that long. Arcibald, Ossa, and I assembled the decoy, while the rest of Cell 317 assembled the cold black mirror. The decoy was erected on a base consisting of 7 Magnifiques lashed together in a hexagonal array. We scavenged propellants from the blue payloads, just as Sura Esma had earlier done with water, and loaded it into the decoy's tanks. That took care of propulsion. On top of this platform, we attached what looked like a big, unruly wad of fabric. It was an inflatable structure that had come up as a separate payload. There was a zipper in its side. We opened it and stuffed in everything we didn't need. Nets, leftover packing material, parts of other Magnifiques. Also, there were 4 mannequins dressed in coveralls. We closed the zipper to prevent all of that junk from drifting out and opened it from time to time as members of the other team came to us with stuff they wanted to get rid of. But we didn't inflate it yet, because space on this side of the balloon was tight and getting tighter as the cold black mirror took shape. My description of the cold black mirror might make it sound heavy, but like everything else up here, it weighed practically nothing because it was slapped together of inflatable struts, memory wire, membranes, and aerogels, 50 feet on a side. Its upper surface was perfectly flat. It was a membrane stretched like a drumhead between knife edges and perfectly reflective. It was made of stuff that would reflect not only visible light, but microwaves, the frequencies that the geometers used for radar. When we ventured out from behind the balloon, we would keep it between us and the Dabanernud, but angled like a shed roof, so that their radar beams, as they swept across our vicinity, would be bounced off in some other direction. We'd still make a big echo, but it would never come anywhere near the Dabanernud, and never show up on their screens. As long as we were careful about which way the mirror was pointing, we would not be visible against the backdrop of space, because the mirror would be reflecting some other part of space, and all space looked more or less the same, black. If they just happened to zoom in on us with a really good telescope, they might happen to notice a star or two in the wrong place, but this was unlikely. When we passed between the Dabanernud and the luminous surface of Arb, it would be a different matter. But we were hoping that a 50-by-50-foot snatch of absolute blackness might go unnoticed on a backdrop 8,000 miles across. It would be like a single bacterium on a dinner plate. If the mirror were permitted to get warm, it would emit infrared light that the geometers might notice. And so most of the ingenuity that had been spent on its design had been devoted to keeping it cold. It was laced with solid-state chillers that were powered by the nuke. The nuke, as Jessrey had mentioned, produced a lot of waste heat. This would show up like a casino on infrared, if we were dumb enough to shine it at the Dabanernud. But as long as we kept the radiators hidden beneath the cold black mirror and pointed in the direction of Arb, the geometers would not have a line of sight that would make it possible for them to see it. Propulsion was, to get us started, 3 scavenged Magnifiques, and, for later, a reel of string.
Our spacesuits would serve as living quarters, beds, toilets, refectories, drugstores, and entertainment centers. But not as cloisters. Space travel had any number of interesting features, but quiet contemplation was not among them. During Apert, and later when we had been evoked, the worst part of the culture shock had been the Jijas. There was no estimating how many times I'd said to myself, "Thank Cardus I'm not chained to one of those awful things." But this was like living inside of a Jija, a super ultra mega Jija, whose screen wrapped all the way around my field of vision, whose speakers were jacked into my ears, whose microphone transmitted every word, breath, and sigh to attentive listeners on the other end of the line. Part of it was even inside of me. That huge temperature transponder. We were only allowed to work for 2 hours before a mandatory rest break kicked in. And as I began to suspect, round about the second or third such break, it wasn't so much to give our bodies a rest as it was to rest our souls from the bewildering, overwhelming, irritating barrage of information being pumped into our ears and eyes. Strangely, when I got a moment's peace, I only wanted to talk to someone. In a normal way. "Tullia, you there?" "I am shocked you haven't fallen asleep," she joked. "You're behind schedule. Get cracking and relax." I laughed, not. "Sorry," she said. "What's up?"
"Nothing. Just thinking is all."
"Uh-oh.
Are we the right people, out of all Arb, to be up here doing this?"
That decision has been made, and the answer is yes.
"But how did it get made?"
"Wait a minute, I know. Ayla rammed it through some committee." "Maybe it wasn't so much a ramming kind of thing," Tullia said, and I had to smile at the distaste in her voice. "But you're right that Ayla had a lot to do with it."
"Fine, no ramming, but I'll bet it wasn't all sweet persuasion either. Not all rational dialogue, not with those people."
"You'd be surprised how far rational dialogue goes with wartime military."
"But the military must have been saying, 'Look, this is obviously a job for our guys, commandos, not a bunch of avowed, a renegade Ida and a starving alien.'"
"There is a backup team," Tullia allowed. "I think it's all military. Same training as you guys."
"Then how did the decision get made to—"
"Partly a language issue. Jules Verne Durand is a priceless asset. He speaks Orth, not Fluckish. So the team would have to be at least part Orth-speaking. To make it bilingual would pose all sorts of problems."
So we were probably the backup option until Jules fell into our laps."
"He didn't fall into your lap," Tullia reminded me. "You went out and—"
"Be that as it may, I still find it amazing that the Pendrondrums would even entertain the idea, given that they have commandos and astronauts who know this kind of thing cold."
"But Raz, you are educable. You can learn this kind of thing, if by that you mean how to maneuver an S-235B and how to assemble a coal black mirror. You've spent your whole life, ever since you were collected, becoming educable."
"Well, maybe you have a point there," I said,
remembering the hitherto inconceivable sight of Fra Archibald powering up a nuclear reactor. "But the clincher, and here I'm just imagining how Ayla would have framed the argument, is that the whole mission, the journey you and the others are going on, isn't going to be just this. When you get where you're going, who knows what you'll be called upon to do? And then you'll have to draw on everything you know, every aptitude you've ever acquired since you became a FID."
"Since I became a FID. Now that seems like a long time ago."
"Yeah," she said. "I was thinking about it the other day. Finding my way through that labyrinth, coming out into the sun. Grand Sewer Tamara taking me by the hand, making me a bowl of soup. And I remember when you were collected."
"You showed me around the place," I recalled, "as if you had lived there for 100 years. I thought you were a thousander."
I heard a sniffle on the other end of the link and closed my eyes for a minute. The suit was built to handle just about every excretory function, except for crying. How could I ever have been so stupid as to think I could be in a liaison with Tullia? Now that would have been a mess. "You ever talk to Ayla? Are you in touch with her?" I asked. "I probably could if I had to," she said, "but I haven't tried."
"You've been busy," I said.
"Yeah,
When your cell got shot into space, it made her really important. Really busy.
Well, I hope she's busy figuring out what we're going to do when we get there.
I'm sure she is, Tullia said. You can't imagine how seriously Ayla takes her responsibility for what she's... for what happened.
In fact, I have a reasonably good idea, I said. And I know she's worried we're all going to get killed. But if she could see how well the cell is working together, she'd take heart.
We dropped behind Arb yet again. I had lost track of how many times we had swung in and out of the Dabin Ernut's line of sight. The others were strapping themselves down to the thrust structures under the cold black mirror. I was up underneath the decoy, running through the final 17 items on a checklist that was 200 lines long.
Pull in the inflation lanyard, I proclaimed, and did. It's done.
I couldn't hear the hiss of escaping gas in space, but I could feel it in the hand that was gripping the frame of the decoy.
Check,
Leo said.
Monitoring inflation process, I said, numbly reading the next line of techno bullshite.
The listless wad of painted fabric, which we'd been using as a garbage receptacle for the last day, stirred and began to show some backbone as internal struts filled with gas and began to stiffen. For a while, I was afraid it was failing, not enough gas or something. But finally, over the course of a few seconds, it snapped open.
Status?
Leo demanded. Down under the mirror, he could see nothing.
The status is, it's so beautiful I wish I could climb into it and go for a ride.
Check.
Commencing visual inspection, I said.
I spent a minute clambering over the thing, admiring its origami attitude thrusters, its paper light, memory wire, and polyfilm antennas, its hand-painted scorch marks, and other marvels of stagecraft that laboratory at the Convox must have toiled over for weeks. I found a thruster that had failed to unfold and popped it loose with my fingers, whacked on a creased struck until it inflated itself properly, flicked off a clinging stripe of kitchen wrap.
It's good, I announced.
Check.
The remaining items on the list were mostly valve openings and pressure checks down among the engines. I was conscious that a plumbing failure here would kill me, but had to get on with it.
10 minutes to line of sight.
The final step was to set a digital timer for 5 minutes and to start the countdown. Leo's final check was still in my ears when I felt a mighty yank on my safety line. Osa hauling me in. A few seconds later, I was down beneath the mirror and the others were strapping me down as if I were a homicidal maniac at the end of a day-long chase. All communications had devolved to a series of checklist items and clipped announcements.
8 minutes to line of sight.
My suit's airbags inflated. Light flared as the mirror's engines came on, and I felt the thrust against my back. As usual, our faces were aimed in the wrong direction so we could not see that anything was happening. But this time around, we had a Speely feed to watch, so we were able to see the balloon and the decoy dwindling into the distance. By the time that the 5-minute timer expired, the decoy was so far away that we could see nothing of it except for a single blue-white pixel as its engines fired. A few minutes into its burn, the geometers could see it too, because by then, the Dabin Ernut's orbit had taken it back into line of sight. Our engines had performed their mission of kicking us into a new trajectory that would get us up to the same altitude as the geometers. We'd never used them again, so we were back in freefall. The in-suit airbags deflated. I loosened a couple of straps and twisted around so that I could see the decoy. Its engines continued to burn for another minute or so, as if it were making a spirited attempt to climb up out of low orbit and get on an intercept course with the Dabin Ernut. Then it blew up. It was supposed to. Rather than wait for the pedestal to do something about it, something we couldn't predict, something that might have unwanted side effects on us, the designers of the mission had deliberately programmed the engines to open the wrong valve at the wrong moment. So it flew apart. There wasn't much in the way of fire, and obviously we couldn't hear the boom. The thing just turned into a rapidly expanding mess of smithereens and ceased to exist. Only a few minutes later, we began to see streaks of fire drawn across the atmosphere below us as chunks of it began to re-enter. The pedestal, we hoped, would think that our pathetic gambit had failed because of a malfunctioning rocket engine,
which was all too plausible, and would put all of their sensors to work, snapping pictures of the debris, greedily vacuuming up all the intelligence they could get before it was engulfed and burned by the atmosphere. The cold black mirror they would not see. The next phase of the journey lasted for several days. It couldn't have been more different from those first 24 hours. We no longer had that high bandwidth link to the ground. Between that and the fact that we didn't have much to do, things got quiet. The burn that had taken us out from the shelter of the balloon had put us in a predicament, vis-a-vis the Dabin Urnud, a little like that of a bird that is on a collision course with an aerocraft. We would definitely reach the Dabin Urnud now, but if we didn't want to end up as a spray of freeze-dried flesh on its rubbly surface, we would need to slow down before we smacked into it. Any other space mission would have done it with a brief rocket engine burn at the last minute, followed by some nice work with maneuvering thrusters. But since we were trying to sneak up, that wouldn't work. We needed a way of generating thrust that didn't involve a sudden brilliant ejaculation of white-hot gases. The Convox had found the answer in the form of an electrodynamic tether, which was nothing more than a string with a weight on the end, with electricity running through it in one direction. The string was about 5 miles long. It was slender but strong, similar to our cords. In order to keep it taut, we had to dangle a weight from the end. The weight turned out to be our spent and now useless Magnifix, concealed under a smaller and simpler version of the coal black mirror. So our first task, once we had broken out from the shelter of the balloon, was to lash the Magnifix together into a compact mass, to deploy another mirror above them, and to attach them to the end of the tether. We waited until Arb was between us and the Dabin Urnud before commencing the most ticklish, verging on insane, part of the operation, which was to throw ourselves into a spin and then use the resulting centrifugal force to pay out the 5 miles of line. This was sickening and terrifying for a few minutes, until we and the counterweight got a little farther apart. This slowed the rate at which we and the counterweight spun around our common center of gravity so that Arb was no longer whipping past us quite so frequently. By the time the counterweight was at the end of the string, the rotation had slowed to the point where we barely noticed it. From now on, we would spin exactly once during each orbit, which simply meant that the counterweight was always 5 miles below us, the string was oriented vertically, and the cold black mirror was always above us, where we wanted it. This slow rotation yielded pseudogravity at a level of about 1/100 of what we felt on the surface of Arb, so we and all of our stuff slowly fell upwards, away from the planet, unless something stopped us. The something was the frame of inflated tube struts that helped keep the cold black mirror stretched out flat. We drifted up against it and remained caught there like litter pressed against a fence by an imperceptible breeze. Shortly after completing this maneuver, we passed onto the night side of Arb. This afforded us an excellent view when the pedestal rotted all of the big orbital launch facilities around Arb's equator. The planet was mostly black, with skeins and clots of light sprawling across the temperate parts of the landmasses where people tended to live. The incoming rods drew brilliant streaks across this backdrop, as if thonic gods trapped beneath Arb's crust were slicing their way to freedom with cutting torches. When a rod hit the ground, its light was snuffed out for a moment, then reborn as a hemispherical bloom of warmer, redder light, comparable to a nuclear explosion, but without the radioactivity. We orbited over the very launch pad from which Jezri had begun his first journey into space and got a perfect view of an orange fist reaching up toward us. Jezri was fussing over the tender at the time, but he paused in his labors for a few minutes to watch as we flew over. I heard a little mechanical pop and looked over to see that Arcibald had just jacked a hardwire into the front of my suit. This was how we'd be talking to each other from now on. Even the short-range wireless was considered too much of a risk. Instead, we physically connected ourselves suit to suit with wires. Likewise, we no longer had the 24/7 high bandwidth link to the ground. Instead, Saman was bringing up some kind of link that squirted information, slowly and sporadically, along a narrow line of sight beam that the geometers would not be able to detect. So if Cell 87 had anything to say to me after this, They'd say it in the form of text messages that would flash up on the virtual screen inside my face mask, but not immediately. We had been told to expect delays on the order of 2 hours. And if we didn't hardwire ourselves into the reticule, we'd not be able to send or receive anything.
It is a high wire act,
Archibald remarked. Out of habit, I looked at his face mask, but saw nothing except for the distorted reflection of a mushroom cloud. So I looked down at the screen mounted to his chest and saw his face, staring down at Arb, then glancing up to make eye contact of a sort. I collected myself for a moment. This was the first real conversation I'd had in days. Since I'd choked down the big pill and climbed into the suit, every sound I'd made, every beat of my heart, every swallow of water I had taken, had been recorded and transmitted somewhere in real time. I'd gotten into the habit of assuming that every word I spoke was being monitored by pension rooms, discussed in committees, and archived for eternity. Hardly a way to have an honest or an interesting conversation. But I'd very quickly adjusted to not having Cell 87's voice in my ears. And now Archibald and I had the opportunity to talk. No one else was hardwired to us. We were alone together, as if strolling through the page trees at Edhar. High wire was a play on words, a literal description of the tether that we had just unreeled. But of course Archibald meant something else, too. Yes, I said. As we have torn open one payload after another, I've been keeping an eye out for anything that would serve as a... And I checked myself on the verge of lapsing into astro jargon. I'd been about to say, atmospheric re-entry and deceleration system, but it sounded as wrong here as it would have back among the page trees. Archibald finished the sentence for me.
A way down.
Yeah. And now that we've unpacked everything and thrown away most of it, stripped down to the absolute basics, it's clear that there is nothing here that can get us back to Arb. Never was. I thought about it as I watched another mushroom cloud skidding along below us, rapidly diluting itself and paling like dawn in the cold upper atmosphere. Archibald picked up the thread I had dropped.
So you told yourself that they would send up a re-entry vehicle for us later, launching it from, say, there or there.
He pointed at the mushroom cloud we had just passed over, then at another, new one, burgeoning a few thousand miles to the east of it.
Or wherever that's going.
He was obviously referring to another rod that was just now streaking across the atmosphere below us. I don't know what it hit. Maybe a rocket factory. Of course, Archibald was making the point that we were all dead now, beyond rescue, unless we could make it to the Dabinernud. I was irked, just a little, that he had put this picture together a bit quicker than I had. And I was also thinking, here we go again, bracing myself to spend the next 10 hours hard-linked to Archibald, trying to talk him down from a condition of near hysteria, persuading him to gulp sedatives from the supply that, I presumed, was stored somewhere in the suit. But he wasn't being that way at all. He was grasping the truth of our situation as clearly as anyone could, more so than I'd done. But he wasn't upset. More bemused. When we were evoked, I reminded him, you said there was a rumor we'd just get taken off to a gas chamber.
Indeed,
he said.
But I was envisioning something much simpler, quicker, less expensive.
It was the kind of joke that would only be ruined by my laughing out loud. I somewhat wished that Jessery and Leo could be in on it. But indeed, before too much longer, our conversation flagged. Archibald disconnected from me and began making the rounds, as if table-hopping in the refectory. He was connected to Jessery when Jessery applied power to the tether. This was a simple matter of pumping electrical current down the wire to its far end. Of course, in order to make an electrical circuit, there had to be some way for those electrons to get back up to the nuke. Normally, that would have been provided by a second wire, parallel to the first, as in a lamp cord. Here, though, that would have defeated our purposes. Fortunately, we were in the ionosphere, the extreme upper atmosphere permanently ionized by the radiation of the sun, so that it conducted electricity. We got the return path for free. Current only flowed in one direction along that wire. Consequently, it interacted with Arb's magnetic field in such a way as to generate thrust. Not a lot of it, not like a rocket engine, but unlike a rocket engine, we could run it continuously for days
and gradually spiral into the desired orbit. Still, all this time later, the orbit that Ayla and I had watched the Dabin Urnut settle into by following a trail of sparks across a page in the Presidium. As long as Arcibald was hardwired to Jezri, he acted as communicator to the rest of us, getting our attention with sweeping arms and pantomiming a suggestion that we all grab onto something. Then he counted down with his finger. At 5, one of his skellahands became redundant, and he used it to grasp a bracket on the control panel of the nuke. At 1, he grabbed the bracket with his other hand as Jezri flipped a switch. The result was not dramatic, but it was perfectly obvious. We saw the tether adopt a slight bow, just like a taut string being acted on by wind. As it did, the cold black mirror yawed around slightly and settled into a new angle, no longer looking straight down at the surface of Arb, but now canted almost imperceptibly sideways. And that was the whole event. We were under thrust now, as surely as if Jezri had fired a rocket engine. It was, though, a thrust too subtle for our bodies to feel it, and it would have to act on us for days to have any effect. Once that had been done, I had a few moments to think about what Arcibald had been saying. Even taking into account Jules and Jad's medical troubles and my nuke escapade, it had to be said that the launch and the assembly of the cold black mirror, the firing of the decoy, and the deployment of the tether had all gone better than we'd had any right to expect. No one had turned up dead or mysteriously failed to turn up at all. There had been no accidents, no one drifting helplessly away. We had recovered as many of the payloads as we needed. Since that had seemed like the most obviously fatal part of the mission, it had put me in too sunny a mood. But 10 seconds' reflection sufficed to make it obvious that this was a suicide mission.
Causal Domain. A collection of things mutually linked in a web of cause and effect relationships. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Social conventions evolved. I thought some might take it the wrong way if 2 or 3 of us jacked together for a private conversation, but I didn't feel thus when I noticed Leo talking to Osa or Saman to Jules Verne Durand, and soon it became clear that everyone in the cell was happy to afford others privacy. Saman strung a network of wires through the frame that everyone could connect to when it was necessary to have an all-hands meeting, and we agreed that we'd do so every 8 hours. The intervals between those meetings were free time. Each of us tried to devote 1 out of 3 to sleeping, but this wasn't going so well. I thought I was the only one having trouble with it until Arcibald drifted over during a rest period and connected himself to me.
You sleeping, Roz?
Not anymore.
Were you sleeping?
No, not really. How about you?
Up to this point, it had been the same, word for word, as the conversations we had used to have in the middle of the night back when we had been newly collected FIDs, lying in unfamiliar cells, trying to sleep. Now, though, it took a new turn.
Hard to say, Arcibald said. I don't feel as if I'm going through normal sleeping and waking cycles up here. Frankly, I can't tell the difference between dreaming and waking anymore.
Well, what are you dreaming about?
About all that could have gone wrong.
But didn't?
Exactly, Raz.
I haven't heard the whole story yet of how you rescued Jad.
I'm not even certain that I could relate it coherently, he sighed. It exists in my mind as a jumble of moments when I thought or did things, and every one of those moments, Raz, could have gone another way. And all of the other outcomes would have been bad ones, I'm certain of that. I replayed in my head over and over, and in every case I happened to do the right thing.
Well, it's kind of like the anthropic principle at work, isn't it? I pointed out. If anything had been a little different, you'd be dead, and so you wouldn't have a brain to remember it with. Arcibald said nothing for a while, then sighed.
That is as unsatisfactory as anthropic arguments usually are. I'd prefer the alternate explanation.
Which is?
That I'm not only brilliant, but cool under pressure.
I decided to let this go. I've had dreams, I admitted. Dreams in which everything is the same except that you and Jad aren't here because you croaked.
Yes, and I've had dreams in which I let Jad go because I couldn't drag him back and watched him burn up in the atmosphere below me. And other dreams in which you didn't make it, Raz. We recovered the nuke, but you had simply vanished.
Then you wake up, I began.
I wake up and see you and Jed, but the boundary between waking and dreaming is so indistinct here that sometimes I can't make out whether I've gone from dreaming to waking or the other way around.
I think I see where this is going, I said. I might be dead, you might be dead, Jed might be dead.
We become like Fra Orlo's wandering 10,000-year math, Archibald proclaimed. A causal domain cut off from the rest of the cosmos.
Phew.
But there is a side effect that Orlo never warned us of, he continued, which is that we've gone adrift. We don't exist in one state or another. Anything's possible. Any history might have happened until the gates swing open and we go into Apert.
Either that, I said, or we're just sleepy and worried.
That is just another possibility that might be real, Archibald said.
When we weren't, according to most of us, dozing or, according to Archibald, drifting between distinct but equally real world tracks, we were studying the Dabinernud. A few paragraphs worth of description from Jules Verne Duran, disseminated over the reticulum, had given the anti-swarm enough information to build a three-dimensional model of the alien ship that, according to the Lateran, was eerily faithful. Blow a balloon out of steel, almost a mile wide, and fill it half full of water. Repeat three more times. Place these four orbs at the corners of a square close to one another, but not quite touching. Repeat with four more orbs. Stack the new set atop the old, but give it a 45-degree twist so that the upper orbs nestle into the clefts between the ones below, like fruits stacked at a greengrocer's. Pile on two more such orb squares, repeating the twist each time. Now you have 16 orbs in a stack a little more than 2 miles high and a little less than 2 miles across. Running up the center of the stack is an empty space, a chimney about half a mile in diameter. Pack that chimney with all of the good stuff, all of the complicated, expensive, exquisitely designed praxis that we have long associated with space travel. Much of it is nothing but structure, steel trusswork to grip those orbs and hold them securely in their places, while the entire thing is spinning around at one revolution per minute to create pseudo-gravity, maneuvering to dodge incoming bogies, managing the resultant slosh, accelerating under atomic power, or all of the above. Once you're satisfied it's never going to fall apart structurally, weave in all of the other stuff, a storage magazine capable of holding tens of thousands of nuclear propulsion charges, reactors to supply power when the ship is far from any sun, inconceivably complex plumbing and wiring, pressurized corridors along which Ernudans, Troans, Laterans, and Phothosians can move from one orb to another, trunk lines of optical fibers to pipe captured sunlight from the exterior of the icosahedron to the orbs to shine on their rooftop farms. The orbs themselves are comparatively simple. Inside of them, the water's free to find its own level. When the whole construct is spinning, the water flees to the outside and settles into a curve on which gravity is always equal to what it was on the home planet. When the ship is under power, the water settles into the aft part of the sphere and levels out. People live on the surface of the water in houseboats, linked by a web of stretchy lines and held apart by tough air bladders. When the shape of the water changes, there's always a bit of jostling. Like any proper boat, though, these are rigged for that. The cabinets have latches so that they don't fly open. The furniture is attached to the floor so it doesn't slide around. People live as their ancestors did on the home planet and may go for days, weeks, without thinking very much about the fact that they're sealed in a metal balloon being spanked through space by A-bombs, as their families back on Ernud, Tro, Laterra, or Phothos might never think about the fact that they live on wet balls of rock hurtling through a vacuum. This construct, the orb stack, is a nice piece of work, but vulnerable to cosmic rays, wandering rocks, sunlight, and alien weaponry. So, frame walls of gravel around it, and while you're at it, hang the walls on a network of giant shock pistons. The orb stack is suspended in its middle, webbed to it. Anything that relates to the rest of the universe, radar, telescopes, weapon systems, scout vehicles, lives on the outside, attached to the 30 shock pistons, or the 12 vertices where the shocks join together. Three of the vertices, the ones down around the pusher plate, are naked mechanism,
but the other nine are all complex space vehicles in themselves. Some are pressurized spheres where members of the command float around weightless. Others have wide tunnels bored through them so that small vehicles and space-suited persons can pass between the interior of the icosahedron and the remainder of whatever cosmos the ship happens to be in. And one is an optical observatory, better than any on Arb, because it enjoys the vacuum of space. All of this had been modeled, in more or less detail, by the minds of the anti-swarm during the days that my cellmates and I had been assembling spacesuits and playing video games in Elkhazg. The model lived in our suits now. We could fly through it using the same controls, the trackball and the stick, that we had earlier used to steer the Monyafiks. From a distance, it seemed impressively complete, with a kind of organic complexity about it. As I flew in closer, though, to explore the core of the orb stack, I found hovering semi-transparent notes that had been posted by Diffident Avout, writing in perfect orth, informing me with regret that everything beyond this point was pure conjecture. Fra Jad finally got his wish, a sextant. We had been supplied with a device consisting of a wide-angle lens, like Clesthera's eye, that was smart enough to recognize certain constellations, so it could know our attitude with respect to the so-called fixed stars. That, in combination with the positions of the sun, the moon, and Arb, and an accurate internal clock and ephemeris, gave this thing enough information to calculate our orbital elements. Fra Jad seized this tool as soon as its presence was made known and devoted hours to mastering its functions. Now that our adventure had turned into an obvious do-or-die proposition, Jules had given up on trying to conserve what remained of his food and was eating freely. So his energy level sprang back and his mood improved. Whenever he was awake, several others were jacked into his suit, asking him questions about internal details of the ship that had not made it into the model. For example, what the doors looked like, how to operate the latching mechanisms, how to tell a Phothosian from a Troan. I learned that the geometers had a particular dread of fire in the zero-gravity parts of the ship, and that one could not go more than 100 feet without encountering a locker stocked with respirators, fireproof suits, and extinguishers. That still left a lot of free time. 2 days in, I made a private connection with Jesri and told him what I knew of the Everything Killers. Jesri listened attentively, as in a chalk hall, and didn't say much. By watching his face on the Speely screen, I could tell that he was thinking about it hard, talking himself into why it made sense. It had been obvious to him that there was something we weren't being told. Otherwise, the mission made no sense on the face of it. I had given him something to think about. Until he'd thought about it, until he'd had a thought that wasn't obvious, he'd have nothing to say. Text messages trickled in from cell 87 and appeared on my screen. The first few were routine. Then they started getting weird. Tulia, settle an argument down here. What is your headcount up there? I pecked a message back. Pardon me, but are you asking me how many of us are alive? Then I fired the message off. Only after brooding over the exchange for a few minutes did I realize that I hadn't answered her question. By that time, though, we had lost contact with the ground. I called a meeting. We all jacked in. My support cell doesn't know how many of us are alive, I announced. Nor does mine, Jesri said immediately. They claim I sent them a message a few hours ago implying that two of us were dead. Did you?
No.
My support cell sent me no messages at all for quite a long time, said Sura Esma, because they were convinced I had perished in the launch. It makes me wonder if something has gone wrong with the anti-swarm, I said. All of these cells should be talking to each other on the reticulum, right? Comparing notes? We looked at Saman. New body language was required. Since faces could not be seen directly, we had gotten in the habit of shifting our bodies toward the interlocutor to let them know we were paying attention. So 9 spacesuits aimed themselves at Saman. Fra Jad, though, didn't seem interested. He had already jacked out of the meeting and was clambering to a different part of the space frame. But he had scarcely uttered a word since we had reached space, and so we paid him no mind. I was even starting to wonder if he had suffered brain damage.
Something has gone wrong, Saman affirmed. Did the geometers find a way to jam the reticulum? Osa asked.
No. The ret
its physical layer anyway, is working fine. But there's a low-level bug in the dynamics of the Reputon space.
In Eda talk, I said, when you call something low-level, you mean it's really important, right?
Yes. Can you say any more about what this means for us?
Leo requested.
Early in the reticulum, thousands of years ago, it became almost useless because it was cluttered with faulty, obsolete, or downright misleading information,
Saman said. Crap, you once called it, I reminded him.
Yes, a technical term. So crap filtering became important. Businesses were built around it. Some of those businesses came up with a clever plan to make more money. They poisoned the well. They began to put crap on the reticulum deliberately, forcing people to use their products to filter that crap back out. They created syndevs whose sole purpose was to spew crap into the reticulum. But it had to be good crap.
What is good crap?
Arcipolt asked in a politely incredulous tone.
Well, bad crap would be an unformatted document consisting of random letters. Good crap would be a beautifully typeset, well-written document that contained 100 correct, verifiable sentences and one that was subtly false. It's a lot harder to generate good crap. At first, they had to hire humans to churn it out. They mostly did it by taking legitimate documents and inserting errors, swapping one name for another, say. But it didn't really take off until the military got interested.
As a tactic for planting misinformation in the enemy's reticules, you mean?
Osa said.
This I know about. You are referring to the artificial inanity programs of the mid-first millennium AR.
Exactly, Saman said.
Artificial inanity systems of enormous sophistication and power were built for exactly the purpose Fra Osa has mentioned. In no time at all, the praxis leaked to the commercial sector and spread to the rampant orphaned botnet ecologies. Never mind. The point is that there was a sort of dark age on the reticulum that lasted until my Eta forerunners were able to bring matters in hand.
So are artificial inanity systems still active in the rampant orphan botnet ecologies?
Asked Arcibald, utterly fascinated.
The robe evolved into something totally different early in the second millennium,
Saman said dismissively.
What did it evolve into?
Jessery asked.
No one is sure,
Saman said.
We only get hints when it finds ways to physically instantiate itself, which fortunately does not happen that often. But we digress. The functionality of artificial inanity still exists. You might say that those Eta who brought the Rhett out of the Dark Age could only defeat it by co-opting it. So, to make a long story short, for every legitimate document floating around on the reticulum, there are hundreds or thousands of bogus versions, bogons as we call them.
The only way to preserve the integrity of the defenses is to subject them to unceasing assault,
Osa said. And any idiot could guess he was quoting some old Vale aphorism.
Yes,
Saman said.
And it works so well that most of the time, the users of the reticulum don't know it's there. Just as you are not aware of the millions of germs trying and failing to attack your body every moment of every day. However, the recent events and the stresses posed by the anti-swarm appear to have introduced the low-level bug that I spoke of.
So the practical consequence for us,
Leo said,
is that
our cells on the ground may be having difficulty distinguishing between legitimate messages and bogons, and some of the messages that flash up on our screens may be bogons as well.
And this is all because a few bits got flipped in a syndev somewhere,
Jessery said.
It's slightly more complicated than you make it sound,
Saman retorted. But what Jessery's driving at, I said, is that this ambiguity is ultimately caused by some number of logic gates or memory cells somewhere being in a state that is wrong or at least ambiguous.
I guess you could put it that way,
Saman said, and I could tell he was shrugging even if I couldn't see it.
But it'll all get sorted soon, and then we'll stop receiving goofy messages.
No, we won't,
said Frog Ratho.
Why do you say that?
Asked Leo.
Behold,
said Fra Gratho, and extended his arm. Following the gesture, we found Fra Jad at work on the wireless box that was our only link to the ground. He was stabbing it with a screwdriver again and again. From time to time, a piece of shrapnel would float away from it, and he would fastidiously pluck it out of space with a skellahand so that it would not wander out from beneath the cold, dark mirror and return a radar echo. When he was good and finished, he drifted back to the meeting and jacked himself in. Leo remained calm and waited for him to speak. Jad said,
"The leakage was forcing choices, the making of which in no way improved matters."
Okay. So we were, in effect, locked in a room with a madman sorcerer. That clarified things a little. We were silent for a while. We knew there was no point in requesting clarification. Frajad had put it as clearly as he knew how. I saw Jesri looking my way in his spiele display. This is how the encanters do it. He's doing it now,